US and other Western powers to abandon its conquest of China and withdraw its armies, or suffer a trade embargo. Japan had a clear choice of getting out of China, or facing economic strangulation. Since she would not, or could not, get out of China, the embargo was imposed on Japan and Pearl Harbor followed. What if the Japanese, in 1941, had responded to our ultimatum by claiming that a Shinto god had promised China to the Japanese people 2,500 years ago, China being the original homeland of the Japanese? Suppose, for example, the Japanese argued, as does the Likud, that they were not occupying China, but were liberating it to make room for Japanese settlers, and it was necessary to torture and kill troublemaking Chinese to keep order. These hypothetical questions are not as fanciful as a Likud divine right argument. Indeed, the Japanese would have a better case for China than the Likud does for the West Bank and Gaza. The validity of the Japanese claim to its ancient homeland would be supported by 100 million devoutly believing Japanese, vastly more than the number of Orthodox Jews in the world. The Japanese also had a living, breathing God Emperor with lineage going back 2,500 years, who could confirm, if necessary, that China had been promised to the Japanese people. The emperor was officially divine until 1945, and many Japanese believe he continued to be divine until his death. What would be the response of the US to the Japanese position? This is more than an interesting speculation. It puts the Likud's divine right arguments into a rational perspective. This brings us to the final and decisive response to the Likud's divine right argument. Assuming that such a right ever existed, and, over the last 3,000 years, it had not been abandoned, extinguished by adverse possession, revoked by Yahweh God, because of the transgressions of the Israelites, and was, in the eyes of the Zionists, a valid and subsisting right in 1947, it nevertheless cannot be raised today and recognized as a legal or moral right of Israel to the West Bank and Gaza for the simple reason that it was clearly and indisputably forfeited when Israel accepted the partition of Palestine, in having never raised or asserted it at the time that Israel's statehood and the partition resolution was being debated and voted on in the UN. Israel is stopped from doing so now. The only appropriate remedy for Israel might be a request by Prime Minister Shami for a rehearing on the matter by the General Assembly of the United Nations. However, the divine right claim is a dangerous argument which Israel should not in any event pursue. It plays directly into the hands of the so-called hardline Arab countries who believe, for some reason or another, that Israel is an expansionist-minded and predatory power and that even keeping the West Bank and Gaza would not satisfy its territorial ambitions. President Assad of Syria makes a special point that, if the Likud and the Gush Emun biblical positions are accepted as far as Eretz Israel is concerned, then all of the land between the Nile and Euphrates, which includes Syria, as well as Lebanon, Iraq, and Jordan, would belong to Israel. The so-called hardline Arab countries have good reason to be suspicious of Israel's real intentions. If the religious extremists are controlling Jewish religious circles also promote the expansionist tendencies of the State of Israel. An item in Haaretz, August 24, 1985, reported on the distribution of information sheets for school excursions to 60 principals. The author of the document explained, "We are talking about the most convenient method for expansion from the political perspective. We have to reach the Tigris and Euphrates. It's written in the Halakha. There's no argument about this. The only argument is over applying it in practice, whether it needs to be done by force or not. As for the boundaries of the land of Israel, there are no arguments. They are clear axioms. The Arab states can conclude from this that there is no point in making peace with Israel, because there is no limit to the territorial." Israel's argument 3, Israel has a historic right to all of Palestine. It is not clear whether this historic right is independent of divine sponsorship, or whether it is claimed by the Likud, only when the divine right argument is not, for some reason, persuasive. In any event, its chief defect as an argument is that it is utterly meaningless. However, since it regularly appears in print and on television, and the Prime Minister of Israel solemnly speaks of it for all the world to hear, it cannot simply be ignored. Being an argument devoid of meaning, it is only with some embarrassment that an attempt is made here to answer it, since it is logically impossible to do so. Since no help is offered from the advocates of this nebulous right as to its origin, nature, or significance, or how, when and by whom it can be invoked, acquired or lost, one must necessarily improvise and imagine what a historic right could mean, and what the consequences would be, if it were incorporated into international jurisprudence, and applied as a rule of law. If it is intended to mean that there is some inherent historic right of a people to return to lands held by their ancestors, no matter how long ago, and to dispossess or expel the peoples now in possession, then there is little land on earth, except Antarctica, the title to which is not impaired or subject to challenge. If, however, it means that only the Jewish people have this historic right, then we come full circle back to God. On the other hand, if the same principle of historic right applies to mankind as a species, a goodly portion of the population of the US ask what is. The case of the Cherokee Nation. The Cherokee Indian Nation less than 200 years ago occupied, and had occupied, from time immemorial, approximately 40,000 square miles of fertile land located, for the most part, in Virginia, North and South Carolina, and Georgia. Their right to retain these historically held lands was confirmed by a treaty with the U.S. government. The Cherokees were a highly intelligent, civilized and peaceful people. They were agricultural, not nomadic, and, during the early part of the 19th century, were a prosperous and successful society. The Cherokees had developed a thriving lumber industry, had established numerous schools, and built an extensive network of roads. Alone among North American Indians, they had a written language, and had always maintained peaceful relations with their white neighbors. However, by the year 1838, a huge influx of settlers, prospectors, and miners had begun encroaching on their territory, all of whom coveted the Cherokee lands. It was then decided, by the government of the United States under Andrew Jackson, that the Cherokees would really be happier in Oklahoma. The Cherokees did not see it that way, but did not go on the warpath. They simply complained bitterly about this injustice, and took their case to the U.S. Supreme Court, where the great Justice, John Marshall, confirmed the title of the Cherokees to their lands. Justice Marshall did not have an army, but Andrew Jackson did, and it was then that Jackson uttered his famous statement, "John Marshall made his decision, let him enforce it." Jackson dispatched the army to round up the Cherokees, all 18,000 of them. Not being warlike, many tried to escape into hiding, but, eventually, nearly all were captured. The army corralled the Cherokees in military camps throughout a stifling summer, during which many died and many more fell ill. In the fall and winter, the Cherokees were moved west, some in flatboats, some in wagons, others on foot. American Heritage History of the Cherokees describes this sad event in these poignant words. A young private who watched one wagon train pull out wrote that in the chill of a drizzling rain on an October morning I saw them loaded like cattle or sheep into 645 wagons, and started toward the west, when the bugle sounded, and the wagon started rolling. Many of the children waved their little hands goodbye to their mountain homes. The Cherokees had 1,200 miles to go before they reached eastern Oklahoma. At the end of the trek they would forever, after, remember as the Trail of Tears. As their homeland disappeared behind them, the cold autumn rains continued to fall, bringing disease and death. 4,000 shallow graves marked the trail. Marauding parties of white men appeared, seized Cherokee horses in payment for imaginary debts, and rode off. The Indians pressed on, the sullen troopers riding beside them. They came at last to the Mississippi, gray and swollen under the huge unfamiliar sky. The ragged Indians stared across the river at the lands they had never seen, and never wished to see. Behind them lay the East. The graves of their ancestors, places of their birth, the land that they and all the other tribes had loved well, and had struggled to hold, and if there is such a thing as a historic right, can there be any question that the Cherokees have a right to return and repossess their historic homelands? The history is fresh, the facts thoroughly documented, their rights adjudicated by the U.S. Supreme Court. Certainly, the God of Justice must be on their side. What further is needed to invoke and enforce their historic right to